Hello, and welcome to Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine's podcast series. I'm Linda Landrigan, editor of the magazine. Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine is a bi-monthly digest of original crime and mystery fiction. Our podcasts feature authors reading their stories from our back issues, but for this episode, Mark Thielman reads his story from our current issue, January-February 2019. The story is called The Case of the Truculent Avocado. Mark Thielman's first published story, A Meter of Murder, featured poet John Milton as the sleuth. It was the 2015 winner of the Black Orchid Novella Award, which AHMM co-sponsors with the Wolf Pack. After the reading, Mark talks about his inspiration for this story and about reading and writing historical mysteries.
"Why don't you just tell me why you killed the turtle?" the deputy asked, giving me the practiced stare he'd undoubtedly learned in Intimidation 101. I shook my head. "Was," I corrected myself, "an avocado, not a turtle." The deputy paused, momentarily taken aback. The dead guy looked like a turtle, round, dark green shell, mostly smooth, pressed against the floor, light green underside facing up to the fluorescent lights, arrayed along the ceiling of Uncle Bob's Natural Food Emporium. All four green limbs splayed to the sides. Undoubtedly, whenever the deputy pictured a dead turtle, or passed one patrolling some country back road, he always saw it, belly to heaven, shell hard against the farm to market, legs straining till death, trying to right itself. Likely he had never run across a murdered avocado. Certain of his own rightness, the deputy tried again. "What's a man dressed like a turtle doing dead in the produce section of my little town's fanciest grocery store?" I rolled my eyes and looked around the employee break room of the food emporium. It was going to be a long day. Charles wasn't a turtle. The produce manager was wearing an avocado costume. "It is California Avocado Month here at the store. Though," I added, "I can see how it might look that way." "What I see," said the deputy. He slapped the table for emphasis, nearly knocking over his small digital recorder. "What I see is that you're evading the real question I'm asking. And why can't you sit still without squirming? Are you nervous?" I wanted to ask whether the deputy had ever sat through an interview wearing a Russian banana fingerling potato costume. It digs into your backside. If, however, you're a potato and try to complain about a wedgie, no one takes you seriously. So I thought better and decided to just answer the question I'd been asked. "No, I'm not nervous." "How did you end up in the same grocery store as a dead trick-or-treater?" Now that was a question I had asked myself. I explained that I made my living as a private investigator. I liked the work, got to set my own hours and be my own boss. The job gave me the free time to work out at the gym regularly, and I felt in the best shape of my life. The problem was that the work was sporadic and the client's checks didn't always clear. A while back, I had helped a woman get divorced from her cheating husband. The woman had been some public relations flack who knew somebody at the Potato Advisory Board. One day, she made the introductions. I didn't feel the need to mention that she'd gotten the idea when she'd seen me coming out of her shower. Anyway, my tanned and recently enhanced biceps paired well with the Idaho russet costume they had me try on. Now I had a part-time gig as a special assistant in potato promotions. The women at the board called me simply the Spud Stud. "So the avocado," the deputy corrected himself. "He was your boss?" "I'm a special assistant for the potato board. I work with the produce manager, not for the produce manager," I patiently explained, emphasizing the difference. "I'm just a deputy sheriff in a small, quiet, conservative Texas community. Why don't you explain what exactly does a special assistant do?" The lawman leaned back in one of the break room's plastic chairs and waited. His face told me that he didn't really care about the answer, but was looking for a lie on which I could hang myself. What could I say? That I was like a rodeo cowboy, only without the leather tack and broken bones? I rode a circuit in my beat-up Toyota Pathfinder with a footlocker full of potato costumes in the back. Should I complain that I bake inside a potato costume? Or that the voice on my GPS is my only friend? No, I decided to give him the script as written by the board. I tout potatoes as hot and wholesome. I introduce people to the differing colors and nuanced flavors available from the array of potatoes grown by American farmers. I encourage customers to challenge their taste buds by trying the potato puree. Here, I lowered my voice and ad-libbed, giving him some inside information. It's really a blender smoothie, but the marketing department liked the alliteration of puree and potato. You should try one. As I said it, his glazed eyes told me that the deputy wouldn't try anything from a blender that didn't have ice, rum, and a pink paper umbrella. But I continued. The board likes alliteration. The only thing I'm not supposed to do is call a potato a tuber. Research says that people associate that word too closely with cancer. Are you saying old Charlie died of cancer? The deputy said, leaning in this time for emphasis. Because it sure looks to me like he got stabbed to death with a carrot. Actually, it looked to me like an organic heirloom parsnip, I said, trying to move the investigation forward. But don't be ashamed. I'm a vegetable professional. The deputy narrowed his eyes and looked at me hard. So you know vegetables. With Charlie out of the way, you could be produce manager. Sounds like I found me someone with motive. I didn't correct him this time. And the killer was someone Charlie knew. No sign of a struggle. Didn't even mess up the green paint on his turtle arms or legs. I know how interrogations are supposed to go. Just answer the questions and never volunteer information. But I just couldn't help myself. You're right. He caught me stealing organic bean sprouts. I had to kill him. Once I got to be produce manager, I'd get the first pick of the expired lettuce packages. Do you know the black market for that stuff? His expression stayed hard, boring into my face. I think you're mocking me. You know what they do to potato boys in jail? I turned my palms up and opened my arms wide. The courses that I'd been to said that this was the classic body language for demonstrating nothing to hide. Look, Sheriff, I've only been here 3 days for the potato promotion. I didn't know Charles well. All I can tell you was that he was an angry man whose wife divorced him because he watched too much porn, had a thing for girls and vegetables, took his work too seriously. The deputy's eyes dipped to the table for just a fraction. Apparently he hadn't known about the pornography. He should spend less time bent over the corpse and more time absorbing rumors over in dairy and cheese. I'll bet you find a closet full at his apartment, I said. His ex got the house. And you know I didn't kill him. I held up my swipe card. This store has a computerized timekeeping system. I just got here a few minutes before you showed up. The deputy sweated me for a full minute with his stare. I showed better judgment this time and didn't offer up any mock confessions. He and I discovered, had differing senses of humor. Finally, he pointed a finger at me. That thick digit would have looked impressive under the glass at Uncle Bob's butcher counter, laying alongside the other sausages. Don't leave my jurisdiction, he said. I'm gonna wanna talk to you some more. Gonna wanna? I repeated. So does that mean I shouldn't leave produce, the store, the county, or the state? The deputy growled and stalked past me out of the break room. I stayed seated. I needed to think. I'm not sure making him mad is exactly your best strategy, a silvery voice behind me said. I twisted in my chair and looked. Babette the Baguette stood there, not in uniform. Hey, Babs, I said simply. You know that's not my real name, she said as she moved to the table and sat down. It was easy to do. The deputy hadn't bothered to push his chair back when he stormed out of the room. Deborah Lanning had been a B-movie actress who sacrificed her 20s and 30s around Hollywood chasing dreams of stardom. She had told me that her film oeuvre included being the third screamer on the right in Thief of Time and third bimbo on the left in Killing Time. I had to go look the word up. Oeuvre, not bimbo. She rounded out her filmography with small parts in a couple of short-lived sitcoms. You're right, I agreed. Making him angry was probably not in my best interests. My teachers always said I had self-control problems. I did a commercial for a men's pharmaceutical to help you with that, she volunteered. Different sort of self-control. I also know a little about handcuffs, she said. That drew a look. I had a part in a police drama, the tone now barbed. I was the PTA president who was also the junkie prostitute. At the end of the episode, I got taken to jail. It was allergy season. Trust me, you don't want to sit in handcuffs with hay fever. If I can stay out of the slammer until 10 p.m., I'll catch the local news and remember to check the pollen count. All I'm saying, she said, ignoring my remark, is that I know a little something about bad career moves. Sounds to me like you're making one. At that moment, I had to agree. Here at the store, Deborah was Babette the Baguette, the exotically accented loaf of French bread who shilled bakery items and signed autographs. A poster with an old publicity photo of her sat on an easel just inside the sliding front doors of Uncle Bob's Natural Food Emporium. She raised up slightly out of her chair and angled it a few degrees so that I was looking at her more in profile than I had been. My face must have reflected curiosity. "Force of habit," she said. "This is my good side. Always have to remember the camera angles." If she didn't look quite as good as she did in the publicity photo, well, unlike any other baguette I'd ever had, I wouldn't throw her out just because she'd gotten a couple of days old. "I doubt you have a bad side," I said. "You big sweet potato." Since Babs and I were getting along so famously, I excused myself for a moment and went out to the deli. Uncle Bob's keeps its selection of fine wines and craft beers there. I picked out a Merlot and gathered a sleeve of plastic cups from the aisle stocked for football tailgating. I figured that since the police were keeping the customers away by swathing the store in crime scene tape, the loss of a bottle of wine wouldn't really matter all that much. Besides, if Uncle Bob made me pay for it, I'd let Babs use her employee discount. She looked up and smiled when I came back inside the break room. "You're sure that a red is the right wine for a murder investigation?" "I couldn't chill a white," I said. "We keep the ice outside, and I'm not supposed to leave the jurisdiction." "I could go," she said. Babs had proven that she hadn't arrived at work until after Charles's body had been discovered. She was in the clear. I felt a small tingle of excitement that she was choosing to stay here with me. I dug around the break room, looking for a corkscrew without success. Uncle Bob, it seemed, didn't want the staff drinking on their breaks. I finally cut the foil off the bottle with a paring knife and pushed the cork down inside with a Sharpie the staff uses when they mark down prices. "Classy," she said as she watched me pour the wine into plastic cups while keeping the cork out of the neck with the marker. "Transports you back to Jeffrey's in Malibu, I bet." She made a small, humorless laugh. Most of those restaurants didn't have a third bimbo section. "So how did you end up here?" I asked. "After I left the industry," she said, "or maybe the industry left me, I bounced around various jobs. I worked for a time at the Splendor Hotel on the Vegas Strip. Everyone on the staff was a retired professional athlete or Hollywood celebrity. I worked the check-in desk with Mickey Tolinati," she said. My face again betrayed me. Babs gave me an incredulous look and explained. "Tolinati pitched 3 seasons for the Cleveland Indians and had a 6.15 ERA. He might have won the Cy Young if he hadn't needed elbow surgery." I nodded. It was a concept hotel. People would pay extra to have their magnetic hotel key made by a guy who once hurled for the tribe or a girl who screamed help in Thief of Time. Go figure. One day, a bunch of Chinese investors bought the place. They pink-slipped us all. Apparently, they didn't like baseball or slasher movies. That's un-American. Babs ignored me again. Uncle Bob had been to the National Grocers Convention out in Vegas. When he heard about us getting canned, he offered us jobs. I took it. And Tolinati? Beer distributorship in Cleveland. I nodded. Makes sense. I knew a little of this information. Every actress has a fan site on the internet. I'd also looked her up on IMDb. I didn't know about the hotel until Babette and I talked over lunch in the break room on my first day here. I loaned her a couple of dollars. She loaned me her employee discount. Together we shared Italian deli sandwiches and sea salt potato chips. Later, she showed me the dressing room where I changed into my potato costume. She'd helped me zip into a gourmet Corolla I was wearing that day. That experience had sort of joined us spiritually. "And now it looks like I'll be leaving here," she said, her eyes downcast, and she bit into her lower lip. I tried to sound encouraging. "The store will be back open in a day or two. Business will likely be bigger than ever. You know what a little scandal can do." "I've learned today that I like special effects blood better than the real stuff," she said quietly, and chewed harder on her lower lip. "At least you know that you get to leave in the front seat of the car. I'm still not sure whether I'm riding out of here in the front or in the back seat." "All this trouble over Charlie," she said, shaking her head. "He was such a rotten human being. I don't think anyone would blame you if you had." I didn't like it that the closest thing I had to a friend in this town was starting to believe that I might have killed the produce manager with a parsnip. I felt moved to say something positive. He couldn't have been all bad. If you liked him, you might call him feisty, she continued. But nobody liked him, so we called him a hot-headed jerk who enjoyed giving orders. We called him the potentate of produce. But he knew his way around fruits and vegetables. Another humorless grunt of laughter. You need to do something. Her eyes automatically cut to the left and to the right. Then she said, you could run. I shook my head. A fugitive in a yellow fingerling costume, never able to go to a farmer's market for fear of being recognized, my face plastered all over wanted posters in the canned vegetable aisle. I shook my head solemnly. That's no life. The look she gave suggested that I was mocking. You could solve the crime. I shook my head again, this time more like Tolinati calling off a pitch. Babette, however, would not be dissuaded. She set her mind on identifying suspects. What about Maria? The checkout girl? Have you heard some of the things Charlie said to her? Babette shivered involuntarily. I couldn't stand it if he talked that way to me. She should sue, not murder, I said. Babette tapped the table excitedly with her finger. The Catfish King. The Catfish King was another product rep. He came through the store periodically in a camouflage baseball cap and a pearl snap shirt with cut-off sleeves. His shtick involved running through a series of redneck jokes and then announcing that catfish was the new bacon. People liked his routine, but remained unmoved. Bacon was the new bacon. Why would the Catfish King want to kill off an avocado? Catfish goes with everything. Maybe he thought Charlie was a turtle, too. You know, people can only buy so much meat. Turtle would be a threat to his livelihood. I'll consider it, I said, but it was clear from my tone that I wouldn't. Bab's mouth settled into a pout. Fine, she said. Solve it yourself. I won't say another word about it. It was equally clear from her tone that the silence wouldn't last. She was a born director. In Death on the Delta, she said, able to contain herself no longer, there was this serial killer loose in my sorority house. We had to solve the crime before we were all gruesomely murdered with a razor-sharp tiara. Bab set down her plastic cup and held up her hand, thumb and forefinger barely spread apart. I was this close to figuring out that it was the freshman we had blackballed after she got her face burned with acid in the chemistry lab. Then she killed me. Damn the luck, I said. But you could do it, she said. Her head bounced around enthusiastically like a bobble-headed dog in the back window of some of the cars in the parking lot. Funny that you mentioned it. When I picked up the wine, I thought about crushing up some charcoal from the tailgate aisle and swiping a fine brush from the cosmetic counter to dust for fingerprints. Then I thought I'd crack open some of the glow sticks from the Halloween seasonal aisle and start looking for blood using chemical luminescence. Her eyes grew wide. You can do all that, she said. Saw it in a seminar. Private investigators have annual classes we have to take. I don't know if I can do all that, but the crime scene guy is just collecting store video, hoping to catch the murder on tape. They aren't doing any of it. My full glory was starting to be revealed. Babette was seeing me now as more than just a costume salesman and sommelier. I abandoned the idea, trying to let her down before she got too enthusiastic. Deputy would arrest me for sure if he saw me throwing charcoal and liquid around the produce department. Babette stood frowning. You need to do something to help yourself, she said. I won't promise I'll wait until you get out of prison. With that, she drained her plastic cup and strode out of the break room. Thanks for the wine. The deputy was coming in as Babs was going out. He paused and held the door open for her. She gave him the high-voltage, starlit smile. Some parts of Babs may have declined with age, but the smile was timeless. After she left, he came into the break room. I could tell he felt taller. He sat down and turned back on his recorder. Your story doesn't check out, Potato Man, he said without preamble. What do you mean? I mean your story doesn't check out, he said, repeating it with deliberate ambiguity. He wanted me to start talking, to careen wildly in my narrative. He should have brought a video camera rather than a small voice recorder to catch my body language tightening up and proclaiming guilt. Since he hadn't gone to the trouble, then neither would I. Well, then, the sources you checked are wrong, I said flatly. His body language drew in a little tighter. He expected to rattle me more with the accusation. After a fraction, he recovered and slowly shook his head. Potato Man, the computers prove you were here when Charlie got killed. Now, you don't need to carry this big, heavy guilt burden around. Just tell me. He gestured towards the door. Did you and the produce manager get into a tussle over that little piece of French pastry that just left? Accidentally stab him? Maybe even self-defense? This cop, for all his chicken-fried idiocy, had been to an interrogation school. He understood the soft sell, proposing an easy, seemingly blameless way for me to confess. He hoped that I'd start babbling about how Charles, the produce manager, attacked and tried to bludgeon me with a gourd or a pumpkin, and I had no choice but to defend myself with a parsnip. "Am I under arrest?" I asked simply. He pursed his lips, gave me a disappointed look. He held the look for a minute, a time that felt like an eternity. "You're not under arrest," he said. "But you're going to be a French fried potato if you don't come clean with me." He held the fixed stare. He put the emphasis on fried. I stifled a Merlot belch. That wouldn't sound good on the recording. He let the recorder run. "I told you earlier not to leave the jurisdiction. Now I want you to stay in the store. Get up, use the restroom, stretch your legs, but stay here. Any reason you can't do that?" He pronounced can't, like can't. "I can." I think that the deputy felt he was being mocked. I got the clear sense that he'd hit me with a phone book, if anybody, anywhere, still had one. But they didn't, so he can't. Instead, he merely switched off the recorder with an angry stab of his thick finger, stood, and leaned over the table. "French fried potato," he repeated, and stormed out of the break room. This time, French took the brunt of his anger. After he left, I wiped the spittle that comes with an exaggerated F sound from my face. I surveyed my quarters. It reminded me of a jail cell, only with a DVD, microwave, and refrigerator. The room seemed small, quiet, and forbidding, and becoming smaller, quieter, and more forbidding by the moment. The picture grew increasingly disagreeable. I didn't have to stay here, I thought, although I knew how I would look if I left the store. I left the Merlot. I didn't want to drink anymore, in case the deputy came back with additional questions. Stepping out of the break room, I walked over to the bakery. Babette wasn't there. I wasn't sure if, when she wasn't working, they called her Babette or Deborah. Didn't matter. No one wanted to make eye contact with me anyway. I circled around to the butcher. Rico moved in and out of the freezer, storing meat that hadn't thawed. The store would remain closed, and he didn't want it to spoil. I called to him, but he didn't seem to hear me. It must be the earmuffs. I pulled down a knife from the magnetic strip that held them. Those carvers sat over the plastic cutting board, colored to look like a butcher block. Rico used them to trim fat from steaks. I considered palming one in case I went to jail. Then I put it back into one of the gaps on the magnetic strip. The sound of metal on metal jarred me. I mostly investigated divorce cases and personal injury claims. I didn't know any more about what really happened in jail than any other television watcher. Next, I walked over to loss prevention, the store's euphemism for the shoplifting catching department. All the video cameras feed into 6 television screens that monitor the store inside and out. The sheriff's office had already copied what they needed from the hard drive. Nobody was present. I spent some time rewinding and viewing, looking for proof that I'd come in after the murder had occurred. I saw a stooped old man shuffling down the general merchandise aisle. He depressed me. Would I be that old, I wondered, before they let me out of prison? I pushed the video to fast forward. I watched until the playback panned bakery, and I caught a glimpse of Babette. I stayed on her image a while, watching her mill about in the area separating the bakery, the deli, and the butcher. Butcher, baker, sandwich maker. Uncle Bob's didn't have a candle department. My mind wandered to our possibilities, if there were any. All in all, it was better than thinking about jail. "What the hell are you doing here?" The voice snapped me around. It was Kathy, the loss prevention supervisor. I should have smelled her coming. "Killing time," I said. Maybe I could have picked a better choice of words today. "Get out of my chair and get out of here. I'm going to have to report this." "Report what?" "That I covered your station while you were beating back the nicotine beast again? I bet you smoke a brand we don't even sell here." Her eyes narrowed to slits. "Get out of here," she whispered. I left. I walked over to bakery, Babette still on my mind. She wasn't there. The bakery manager, however, has a small display of her movies set up. Makes impulse buys easier. I borrowed a copy of Killing Time and carried it back to the break room. Here, I thought no one would scowl at me. I popped the disc into the DVD, and I settled back. Watching the film, it amazed me that the Oscar committee had overlooked it. A maniacal killer framed Babette's boyfriend for murder using a watch set to the wrong time. Babette's role was to allow the director to find as many different ways to get her t-shirt wet as possible. Babette, injured, escaped the killer's clutches and limped to the swimming pool where she hid under the diving board to escape. Just as she emerged dripping from the pool, having surmised the truth, the killer appeared and struck her down. A higher-paid actress got to solve the mystery and kill the murderer three scenes later. It was, I think, a credit to Deborah's acting chops that she was the last of the screamers whom the director killed. At least she got to die in a close-up. I poured the bottom of the wine bottle into my cup. I knew what I needed to do before the detective arrested me. I didn't like it. I found it hard to stand up. I was still sitting, watching the tearful reunion of the heroine and her boyfriend just before the credits rolled, when Babette came back into the break room. She glanced briefly at the actress on the screen. "Bitch." "I prefer Spud Stud," I answered. She cocked her head and looked at me. "I'm going to miss these romantic things you say." Now it was my turn to look at her. "I called Mickey Tolinati. He said he can get me a job as Heidi the Bavarian Brewmaster with the distributorship. I just told Bob and picked up my last check. The bus leaves tonight." "So we're through?" My voice choked. "I could promise we'll call, but we both know that would be a lie. I'll let you keep the baguette costume if it'll help. In Cleveland, I'll be wearing a short dress, arm garters, pigtails, and an apron. How's this? Oktoberfest, yeah," she said, the last line in a lilting accent. Heidi's German accent was not to be confused with Babette's lilting French accent. "Very convincing," I said. "I'm like the Sound of Music with a six-pack. A beautiful woman and a beer. These are a few of my favorite things." Our farewell banter was interrupted by the deputy bursting through the door. He pulled up when he saw that I was not alone. "It looks like you two boys need to talk," Bab said. She took a step towards me and embraced me, pulling my head close to hers. "Run," she whispered. I untangled myself and looked at her. "Stick around, Babs. I may need a witness." "I've got a bus to catch," she said, her eyes on the deputy, who nodded his consent. "I don't think the lady needs to see this," he said. "Deborah, please. I could really use your help right now." "I've only got a few minutes." "This won't take long," the deputy said, seizing the conversation. Businesslike, he sat down and turned on the recorder. He might not have wanted Babs here, but he could hardly argue with a neutral witness to whatever he had planned. I needed Babs here also. "Potato Man, the lies just keep coming," he said. Apparently, this time there was to be no soft sell or suggested narrative. The deputy's eyes cast down at the wine bottle. "I got you on tape stealing this from the store. Now I think that Charlie, the produce manager, caught you embezzling. I've got proof that you lied about it when you came to work today. The computer proves that you were here before Charlie died. Finally, you failed to tell me that you'd taken classes on crime scenes. I can prove that you knew where to stand in order to avoid being caught on the store's video cameras. I've done caught you in a 5-pound bass of a lie, son. Why don't you make it easier on yourself and just tell me exactly what happened?" He sat back, looking triumphant. "And how did you know to check my continuing education classes?" "Potato Man, I don't reveal my investigative sources. Now tell me what happened." "Let me guess," I said. "Was it an anonymous tip from a French maid? Maybe a German Fraulein? I'll take a guess here. I'll bet your tipster had an East Texas accent. Lots of slow talk and extra syllables." "I hear you were going to tamper with my crime scene," the deputy said, trying to retake the initiative. I moved faster. "I only had a conversation like that with one person, the same one who advised me to run, to do things to make me look guilty. Ms. Babette, I think you should depart. This man here is starting to get irrational," the deputy said. She stood to leave. "Make her stay," I said, talking quickly. "Actresses understand about camera angles. I think actors call it hitting the mark. She has years of experience in knowing where and how to stand to avoid the video system in this building." "You being afraid is no reason to start accusing your friends," Babette said, her voice high and innocent. I wasn't even here when it happened. My eyes blazed into hers. You know how to make these access cards from your time at the hotel in Vegas, I said, and I turned to the deputy. She made magnetic keys for a hotel before she came to work here. I turned back to her, my head on a swivel. Or, I know better than anyone how warm these costumes are. You could have safely hidden in the meat locker for hours in that baguette costume. Then, come out in the confusion after the body was discovered and swiped your card into work. I spun back to the deputy. Have you even looked in the meat locker for a knife? There's one missing in the butcher shop. You can't stab someone with a parsnip, organic or otherwise, but you can put a parsnip in a knife wound. Check the video. She's first seen between the butcher counter and the bakery. Babs batted her eyes at the deputy. You checked my hands. You didn't find any blood. I didn't bat my eyes in reply. I didn't think it would help. We're food handlers. There are boxes of plastic gloves all over this place. Ask the director of Death on the Delta. She spent the whole movie wet and cold. This woman knows how to handle a chill if she is determined. All we're doing is wasting time. I'm not going to miss my bus to listen to all these scurrilous accusations. Perhaps the deputy, in the stress of the moment, heard the word all being dragged out a bit longer than it normally would. Perhaps he remembered the anonymous tipster. I'll personally drive you to the bus station, he offered. Let's you and me hear the man out. Babs huffed and sat back hard in her chair, her lower lip erupting into a pout. No attempt at finding her good side. She began the staccato intake of breath, signaling a cry was coming on. Most men rush to aid a woman when tears flow. I pressed forward before my deputy could get gallant. My swipe card could get reproduced or stolen temporarily when we met here in the break room. Go back and watch. Go back and look at the body. Is he wearing a watch? The deputy shifted his weight on the seat. Is that how you know the time of death? Does he have a broken watch smashed in the fight of his life? Is it one of those flexible band watches, the kind that are easy to slip on? The kind the store sells down on aisle 2? Did that metal band scratch away at the makeup on his skin? It would, I bet, if he was in a death struggle with a parsnip-wielding potato. Body paint scratched off, skin showing. But if it was put on after death, then he wouldn't be flailing around. The body paint would be intact. To his credit, the deputy pulled out his phone to quickly check his crime scene photographs. I pushed ahead while I had his attention fully locked on my theory. Have you seen her movie, Thief of Time? We could watch it. I've got it in the player right here. Do you know what the serial killer does to evade capture? He uses a watch. Look at the movie. Poor injured Babette, doubled over in pain, tries to limp to safety. Then go back to the store's surveillance tapes. A stooped old man comes into the store earlier today and shoplifted a watch. Inventory control will prove nobody bought one. You can't see the old man's face. A big hat covers it. Watch the tape, then go look back at her movie. Don't watch the wet t-shirt. Look at the limp. They're identical. This is crazy, Deborah said, her voice rising in anger, the tears of memory. He is making up wild stories to distract you. We've got security. She'd have caught a watch thief. She smokes so many cigarettes, she gets thank you notes from R.J. Reynolds, I answered. Everybody knows when she is outside the employee entrance. Just look for the gray smoke. While the deputy's ears had been tuned to our back and forth, his eyes stayed on the images stored in his phone. He lifted his head and spoke in a calm, matter-of-fact tone. This is nonsense, he said, placing special emphasis on the word is. And Ms. Deborah or Ms. Babette, whatever you prefer, I apologize that you've had to listen to it. A celebrity like yourself deserves better. I think the best thing to do is for me to get you out of here and away from this man and his reprehensible accusations. I'd like you to come downtown with me so that you and I can sit down in a nice, safe place, have some peace and quiet, and talk about this whole misunderstanding. Why don't you come downtown with me now? He extended his hand as gentlemanly and as chivalrously as any character in one of Deborah's movies. She sat still and looked at the hand. I, the deputy, and the recorder all waited quietly. Go to hell. Her batter-dipped East Texas accent came through loud and clear. The scene played itself like a movie after that. The deputy took Deborah to jail. A search found a very cold butcher's knife hidden in the meat locker, along with a pair of blood-stained, vinyl food handler's gloves. Turns out that fingerprints can be located on the inside of vinyl gloves, something they hadn't taught us at school. When the deputy told Deborah about the prints, she started crying, for real this time, crying and then talking. Charles, the produce manager and porn aficionado, apparently had found an old sex movie that Deborah had made when she was clinging to the remnants of her Hollywood career. He had been blackmailing her with threats. Like the deputy said, this is a quiet and conservative town, the kind of place where cheese that isn't cheddar, mozzarella, or an American single is considered suspect. Aging porn stars might have trouble making a peaceful living here. The sheriff's office found the movie during a search of Charles's apartment. The good news for Babs was that at least they hadn't handcuffed her in allergy season. I felt badly when I drove out of town. Deborah and I might have had something if she hadn't tried to frame me for murder. But I'm a forgetting guy, and I would be forgetting her as soon as I crossed over the city limit line. She told me once that she wasn't sure she would wait for me. I knew I couldn't wait for her. The Potato Advisory Board needed the Spudstead to promote Idaho russets and gourmet Viking purple potatoes at a foodie grocer just outside of Denver next week. People ask, where do ideas come from? And that seems to be one of the more common questions anybody who tries to write stories gets. We live in Texas. Guacamole is kind of its own food group down there. So one night we're trying to open up some avocados to make some guacamole, and the pit won't come out. So we, somewhere in the conversation, this got described as the truculent avocado. That became this earworm. I'd love to tell you that there's some lofty message here, but in fact, the story got written mostly because you get this phrase, the truculent avocado, in your head, and I had to write a story to purge it out. The character is supposed to be a vegetable expert. I'm not. So I found myself at sort of one of the good grocery stores in town, the grocery store with the most full produce section, walking around, picking up vegetables, saying, could you kill somebody with this? Could you kill somebody with it? Is this sharp and hard? Could I actually kill you? And I don't know what the other customers thought, but anyway, we found they finally settled on the organic heirloom parsnip as a murder weapon. Every work environment I've been in at some point seems to be the environment we had in high school, right? Whether it's the courthouse where I spend my day, or the jobs that I had, I mean, we have clubs and who's on whose side, and we have, do we have secret romances and who likes whom, and you have all of that. That seems to be, that's just part of the human condition. And so trying to sort of speak to those things and then write a parody of the hard-boiled detective, and to talk about vegetables, were the goals of the story here. Like everyone these days, I mean, the internet is a big source. You can, you can Google potato varieties and get Russian fingerlings and purple Viking purples and Idaho russets, of course. But yes, I mean, there was actually some, unlike some of the historical stories that have written, when you're writing about a contemporary grocery store, you can actually go there and do the work yourself. To this story, it was a combination of digital research and then field work. I mean, one of the reasons I like to read historicals is I like the idea of not only being entertained, but also the feeling that I learned something. And so, the idea that I can get a little smarter while reading a mystery, that's just paradise. So when I'm writing a historical, know, the key is to provide some detail, hopefully accurate. Now, for the story that you're running this month about Captain Cook's adventure in Tahiti, he kept a journal of his time there, and so you can go, you can find it in a hardcover, but you can also find it on the internet, and you can read his thoughts and his recollections about his time throughout the whole voyage, but particularly in the days in Tahiti. And so hopefully by looking at that and, you know, and then some collateral material, I'm able to describe with a reasonable degree of accuracy what transpired. And then of course you set a murder in the middle of a realistic setting. Hopefully people feel, again, that they've been entertained, but that also maybe they've learned a little bit and hopefully piqued your interest to learn a little more.
That was Mark Thielman discussing writing and reading his story, The Case of the Truculent Avocado, from the January-February 2019 issue of Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine. Thank you, Mark. I'm Linda Landrigan, editor of Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine. We're published 6 times a year by Dell Magazines and Penny Publications. To learn more about us, you can go to our website, alfredhitchcockmysterymagazine.com, or look for us on Facebook or on our blog, traceevidence.net. You can find the magazine at your newsstand. Digital editions are also available at all major e-tailers. This podcast was produced with the help of Jackie Sherbo and Deanna McLafferty. I hope you enjoyed it.